Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Gail Green writes, I love this passage. This is such a beautiful book. Insomnia. I don't manage this beast. I live with it. I live around it. I bed down with it every night, gingerly, cautiously, careful not to provoke it. I do my best to placate it, domesticate it, dull its claws, avoid its fangs, knowing that at any moment it can pounce on me and tear me to bits. So some of you might find that very familiar. What Gail Green has done with her book, Insomniac, is a great service to anyone who has ever had to live with this beast. Joyce Carol Oates called Green's book impassioned and fascinating, and not only will you learn the hows and whys of sleep and insomnia, but the book itself is just, it's a beautiful read. Gail Green is a professor of English at Scripps College in Claremont, California. She teaches Shakespeare, contemporary women writers, women's studies, creative nonfiction, and lately courses on sleep. After writing several books on contemporary women's fiction and feminist theory, her interest shifted to health and the environment, and she published The Woman Who Knew Too Much, Alice Stewart and the Secrets of Radiation, a biography of the pioneer radiation epidemiologist whose research turned up the links between fetal X-ray and childhood cancer. She then turned her research to insomnia, which, as she says, has been the bane of her existence since she can remember, and began attending American and European sleep conferences, and she has wonderful descriptions of that in the book. She's a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine and a board member and the patient representative of the American Insomnia Association. In conversation with her tonight is Alex Wexler, who is a research scholar at the UCLA Center for the Study of Women, and she's on the board of the Hereditary Disease Foundation, and the author of two books on Huntington's disease, Mapping Fate, a memoir of family, risk, and genetic research, and The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea, Huntington's and the Making of a Genetic Disease. Alice's books are, like Gail Green's Insomniac, powerful weavings of personal history and scientific research. She writes with clarity and depth about mothers and sisters, about the nature of living at risk, and how her family was alternately driven apart and flung together by a destiny they could not escape. She's been recipient of fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Library of Medicine, and the National Endowment for the Humanities, among others. So after Gail and Alice have their conversation, they will invite you into the discussion. We will have a microphone circulating. Libby will take it around, and we ask just that you wait until it comes to you because we do record for podcast. And afterwards, both of our authors will be signing books in the lobby, and books are for sale tonight courtesy of our library store. So if you buy one here tonight, the proceeds also support the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and the Los Angeles Public Library. So without further ado, please welcome Gail Green and Alice Wexler to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here tonight and to have a chance to have a conversation with my friend Gail Green about this topic that affects so very many of us. Gail, I wonder if we could start out with a little reading. You have a wonderful, some wonderful passages in the beginning of the book about your own experience with insomnia.
Sure. All right, I'll read this without any introduction. When it began for me, I can't remember. The truth is, I remember very little of my childhood. What I do remember is the following scene played out at various times throughout my youth, most vividly in my adolescence. But I can't sleep, I'd wail as my parents tried to wrestle me into bed at what they called a decent hour, a normal hour, as though my hours were not decent or normal, meaning any time before 1 a.m. Nonsense, said my father. Of course you can. Everyone knows how to sleep. Why, even animals know how to sleep. Just close your eyes, relax, and you'll get sleepy. It's the most natural thing in the world, sleep. My father was a normal sleeper, and to the normal sleeper, sleep is the most natural thing in the world. But, Daddy, I can't. I don't know how. Well, you get all wound up. Now, if you'd only listen to your mother and go to bed earlier. He knew it was something I was bringing on myself, some obstinacy of mine that I could change. If only I would do something different, be something different. If only I would change my attitude, change my ways. My father was a doctor, an old-style family practitioner who carried a black bag and delivered babies at home, one of a heroic vanished breed. But that didn't mean he knew a thing about sleep. Sleep had no part in the medical school curriculum at Yale in the 1930s when he was there. Sleep has little part in medical curricula today when doctors get an average of 1 to 2 hours instruction in sleep and sleep disorders. The advice he gave me is a version of the advice I've been hearing ever since. You're stressed out, you're anxious, you're depressed, you have bad habits. These are the things insomniacs are told. There may be, there often is, truth to such explanations, but they may also be ways of passing the buck back to the sufferer, a thing doctors have been known to do when confronted with problems they don't well understand. We also hear a lot of cheer up, it's not so bad advice. Don't worry about it. You probably just worry too much. You probably just need more exercise. Try yogi. Yogi is not, it's not a typo. I do some yoga. I swim 3 times a week and walk on the days I don't swim. As you get older, you need less sleep, a myth that's been called into question by recent research. We may get less sleep as we age, but it's not clear that we need less sleep. You probably sleep more than you think you do. People often do. I run this one by my partner, Bob, martyr to my many sleepless nights. No, I don't think so, he says. In there.
Well, that covers a lot of territory that we're going to go back and talk more about tonight. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you decided to write this book, since your previous books were on very different subjects.
Well, I was so tired of hearing the same old advice, and as you know from that passage, I've been hearing it in a long time. I mean, this is my adolescence. This is 50 years older. I was still hearing the same advice: go to bed at the same time, listen to your mother. Now, they don't say listen to your mother, but they do say, you know, follow the doctor. You know, keep a regular schedule, cut out caffeine, alcohol, that kind of thing. It's just not very adequate to somebody with a chronic sleep problem. So I decided to find out what was with the science that it was still, insomniacs were still hearing the same thing. I mean, even I, in my, you know, English literature, ivory tower, knew that the 1990s had been the decade of the brain and that things were being learned about the brain that hadn't been known before, and technologies existed for looking at the brain. And yet you go into a doctor's office and you still hear the same old advice from half a century before. So that was, I wanted to find out what was going on.
Good reason. Had you ever talked to other people, other insomniacs, before you started writing the book?
Yeah, kind of. We would whisper in hallways, you know. I mean, it's kind of a thing you don't go out public with. I mean, there's a lot of it that's in the closet because there's a kind of stigma attached to it. But I would find that, you know, we would bond. Like, I had a colleague at Scripps, and we, you know, found each other, and then we would share stories and share drug horror stories and things like that. And it just seemed there was an awful lot of it that was just not being talked about, and it would be a good thing to bring it out. And I did find, in some of my, many of my interviews, I would find people who would say, well, I'm not an insomniac, I just have trouble sleeping, and then they would describe a sleep pattern that was a whole lot like mine, but they didn't want the label because of the stigmatization.
That's one of the very, I think, interesting things about this book, is the stigmatization of insomnia and the way in which that's blocked, actually, research. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why this condition should be so stigmatized.
Yeah, it's always easier, if you don't understand a condition, it's always easier to kind of put it back onto the patient. You know, we don't really know what's going on with this condition, therefore it must be something you're doing wrong, especially if many more women than men complain of insomnia, about half, twice as many women. So it's easy to sort of psychologize it, neuroticize it. It's something your, you know, stress, anxiety. You know, you don't have hold of your life. Somehow you don't have a grip, you know. And people just don't want to kind of wear a label that says I'm mentally unhealthy, you know. And that's kind of what that label has, you know, you're neurotic. Well, it, you know, part of it begins with Freud. I mean, Freud, the Freudian legacy in psychology, psychiatry is just enormous. And he kind of gave justification for the anxiety / depression interpretation of insomnia. And then along come, you know, more women than men get it. And so you have this stigma.
Why do you think it is? Or what does the evidence suggest is the might be some of the reasons that more women...
Hormonal, you know, quite clearly hormonal problem, because it comes on at adolescence, the difference between male and female sleep. I mean, before puberty, males and females sleep the same. Then at adolescence, there's just a whole lot more females that have a problem with insomnia. Then it comes on at before the period, and then at pregnancy and after pregnancy and with menopause. Every time the hormones are doing something fluctuating, in other words, it seems to be the fluctuations of the hormones rather than the absolute level of hormones that brings on the problem. But it took researchers until 1998 to figure that out. They did the National Sleep Foundation did a survey, and they found that, lo and behold, sleep patterns really varied with the time of month or the time of life. And you know, part of this is a problem of male researchers studying a problem that afflicts mainly females. And if they had asked their female patients, why, I could have told them that in 1960 or something.
You also talk about how insomnia disproportionately affects the elderly and the poor as well.
Yeah, and these are not favorite research populations either. I mean, they're not elderly, you know, they're on their way out. The poor, they rarely make it in, you know, to see a doctor. So they don't get a lot of attention. I mean, these are neglected populations, and this is who insomnia mainly afflicts. And so it, again, becomes a neglected problem. Yeah, I mean, what I found was there's very little known about insomnia, and it's not a surprise because it doesn't get a lot of research. It gets, in the year 2005, I say this somewhere in the book, it got $20 million of research for insomnia. That's an astoundingly low figure. That same year, Sanofi Aventis spent $123 million advertising Ambien. So that's the discrepancy. And the reason, you know, the reason it doesn't get more research is it, you know, it's neglected populations. It's populations that simply don't get a lot of research.
You know, one of the things that I thought was really fascinating in the book is your discussion of how our contemporary idea that we should sleep 8 continuous hours, or I don't know, 7 continuously, might be quite recent and culturally specific, in that in pre-modern times or pre-modern cultures, people slept in a more segmented, discontinuous way. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, there is evidence. I mean, it comes from two sides. One is a book on the history of night called At Day's Close that found evidence. Is this still working? Yeah. That found evidence in pre-modern letters, literature, diaries of people referring to first sleep and second sleep. And it was just a matter of their vocabulary. I mean, is this working? I am absolutely not hearing. Okay, good. And it seemed, and then there were a series of studies done at the NIH of a man who left his subjects in darkness for 14 hours, which he figured sort of, you know, was the conditions of a European night in northern Europe in the winter. And they actually slept, after they'd made up their sleep debt, they actually slept in two pieces, in two segments. They were actually sleeping quite a bit, too. They were sleeping like more like 10 hours. But this was absolute darkness. They had no electronics of any sort. And it turned out they had this segmented sleep that was very like the sleep that was referred to in diaries and literature in the pre-modern period. And so the thinking is that electricity has actually compressed the sleep into a shorter block. And then the industrialization, which has made sort of factory time, you know, people have to be in at a certain, you know, and on task in the morning. And it has consolidated the sleep, pushed it down into an 8-hour consolidated block, and that some of us just didn't get with the program, you know. I mean, we just didn't evolve quite. And the evidence for that is that in babies and old people and animals actually have this kind of segmented sleep where they kind of go in and out of sleep. And also apparently in developing countries, it's much more, sleep is less regimented. It's just more polyphasic, you know, you go into it and out of it. It also happens to be that, you know, the nations with a consolidated sleep conquered the world. So, I mean, there may be a certain efficiency to this pattern. But it may be with insomnia, an older kind of sleep pattern asserting itself. Mm. There's not much room for us in the world, unfortunately, unless we're freelance or retired or students.
But does that suggest that siesta cultures really are more in tune with
quite
maybe
possibly
the body's needs?
Yeah, quite possibly. Although there's huge variability, you know, whenever you talk about sleep or insomnia, there's just people that either, in siesta culture, there's quite a few people who do not sleep during those periods. It's not like everybody just conks out for 4 hours in the afternoon. There are short sleepers, you know, there are long sleepers, short sleepers, morning people, evening people. But it may be that siesta is a more natural pattern with some people's sleep pattern. And it would be really nice to have a society where we could find this out about ourselves and then actually sleep according to our, you know, what our bodies wanted.
Mm-hmm. So if there could be social changes in the society or the structure of work, then some people who now would be insomniacs might not be?
Is that? Possibly, yeah. I mean, people who have delayed sleep phase syndrome, which just means that your circadian clock is set quite late, you know, some people can actually sleep between 5 a.m. and noon. These people are mangled by the work world. I mean, they just cannot get with, you know, a 9-to-5, an 8-to-5 job. But if you left them to their own devices, they could work on their own time. So if there was flex time and, you know, working from home, all those things would probably bring down the insomnia rate, but considerably, I imagine. Yeah.
So insomnia, in some way, is relative to the environment in which we live.
Well, the way I've survived mine is I'm an academic and I can set my first classes at 4:15 this semester.
Anyway. You know, another, I think one of the key arguments that was really important in your book is that the traits that are often described as the causes of insomnia are really the consequences of sleep deprivation and lack of sleep. So, in a sense, you say that we've got it backwards.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, the anxiety, depression, you know, you have insomnia, therefore, you know, it's because you're anxious or you're depressed. Well, by the time you get yourself into a doctor's office after a long spell of insomnia, you are anxious and depressed. It doesn't matter where or how you started out. You'll get that way, you know. So it always seemed to me that they had the cart before the horse, the cause before the consequence. And in 2005, there was a conference at NIH where they finally have stopped defining insomnia as a secondary condition, secondary to some mainly psychological disorder, and are now defining it as comorbid with anxiety and depression and other states, which takes away the causality and says, yes, these conditions may coexist and probably do coexist in many cases, but that doesn't tell us which is causing which. So it was really wonderful to be on the cutting edge of that line of thinking. Mm. Very gratifying. 2005, though, when I think about that, insomnia has only existed as a primary condition since 2005. That means it can now be taken seriously as a medical entity, and we might do some serious research on it.
So you talk in the book about how, I mean, as you said here, sleep disorders have long been regarded as psychological, psychogenic. As you just said, the results of depression and anxiety, and all in your head, and that's one of the reasons why it's stigmatized. And it made me wonder about why psychological disorders generally are more stigmatized. I mean, why should that be less legitimate and more worthy, you know, more commonly stigmatized than something that's physiological or defined as physiological?
It shouldn't, but it is. I mean, you know, mental health is the poor. I mean, if you have a mental health problem, you don't get certain kinds of insurance recompense. And I mean, it's just not, you ought to be able to get hold of it, you know. I mean, if a person is overweight because they have a metabolic syndrome, that's okay. And if they're overweight because they got a psychological problem, there's not a lot of sympathy for that. But there's so much that suggests, I mean, so much of sleep is genetic. Your morningness, eveningness, length of sleep, sleep need, how you respond to sleep deprivation. The EEGs of twins are, when raised apart, are actually the sleep architecture, the stages they go through, when they go into deep sleep, how much deep sleep they have, that's identical in identical twins. I mean, so much of sleep behavior is a physiological, also the way it wears out with age. This is the way most of our systems do, is a physiological system. And yet to say that the sleep disorders are psychological, and it's been found with narcolepsy that narcolepsy was blamed on the patient. You're lazy, you're crazy, you should get a better diet, stuff like that. And then a neurotransmitter system was found that was defective in narcoleptics. And that was very exciting. That was a huge breakthrough in sleep research. And I think that will happen in insomnia research. It won't be one thing, though. Narcolepsy is one thing. Insomnia is many things. So nothing in insomnia is simple.
So it sounds as like there's a kind of a moral stigma with sleep disturbances as well. You're lazy, you're a slacker, why don't you pull yourself together? And that kind of moralizing. Yeah. Is there anything specifically American about that, or do you think this is true in most cultures?
I want to find out about that. I have an anthropologist coming to Scripps who's talking in a series that I'm giving out there, and that is one of the questions I want to ask her, if it is moralized in other cultures. I mean, eating is also moralized, I mean, how much you eat, what kind of things you eat. People get very virtuous about about their eating. But they sure do about sleep, I mean, I think there's something slightly threatening about sleep. I think people feel on some level that it's kind of mysterious and uncontrollable, and why they sleep well and I don't sleep well is actually not the tendency is to say, I sleep well because I'm doing something right and you're sleeping not so well because you must be doing something wrong. But I think that masks some kind of insecurity about sleep, which is, I think the sleep fairy is kind of like a really good myth. The sleep fairy comes and visits some people and doesn't others. I mean, it is that. Sleep is very mysterious. It is simply not understood why we sleep, even why we sleep. How we sleep is not understood, why we have two kinds of sleep, REM and non-REM, and what are dreams? What are dreams? What are they about? What are they for? None of this is known. So I think there are control issues here, If I'm sleeping well, I must be doing something right. You're not sleeping well, you must be doing something wrong. That's my theory, anyway.
Reward and punishment.
Yeah, something like
that. The state of your soul.
Yeah, and therefore I'm in control of it somehow.
Right.
Yeah.
You had some great descriptions of your experience in sleep clinics, which I found very both amusing and disheartening. And your point that sleep clinics really aren't for insomniacs.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your experience with
sleep
clinics.
I was shocked about that. I mean, I was interviewing a researcher, and he said, well, of course, insurance won't cover a sleep study for an insomniac. And I said, say what? What are they doing with their time then? Well, it turns out apnea, I mean, there's a simple answer to that question. Apnea is a very attractive thing for researchers to work on because you actually can measure it. And you can see it. Insomnia is invisible. How do you diagnose insomnia? Well, you have to hear what the patient says with insomnia, which makes it a subjective condition. And doctors and researchers don't like that, and I understand perfectly well why. You know, I mean, it's dependent on patient report. It's subjective. Not true with apnea. Apnea is, as this one researcher said, well, it's just plumbing, you know. you can see it. You can actually, and you can treat it, which is a very nice thing. That's not always the case with insomnia. So researchers have flocked to it. The clinics are mainly treating it, doing it, and they're making a lot of money from it. I mean, they're not interested in insomniacs. Many insomniacs pay out of pocket, you know, for their sleep studies, and feel very unhappy because they come away with a lecture on behavioral modification or a prescription for Ambien, which is pretty much what I came away with. And you can get that a lot cheaper elsewhere. You don't have to go into a clinic and get all wired up. But they don't know how to treat, you know, and their staff is pulmonary medical people. Their staff has training in apnea, and this is a real division in the sleep research community. I found the basic researchers were very unhappy with this condition because the clinics are wealthy and basic research has been starved of funding. And I heard some just amazingly caustic statements from researchers at the clinics saying, oh, well, apnea is where their bread is buttered. Well, apnea is the only thing they know how to do. And then I heard this one man get up and say, sleep is not a pulmonary function, you know. We shouldn't. But it's tilting. The field is tilting that way. So the clinic experience was, I got a diagnosis of apnea and a lecture on sleep behavior modification.
So basically, we don't know very much about normal sleep,
yeah,
as well as about sleep disturbance and insomnia.
Yeah, yeah, that is what I realized. I had some fabulous quotes from researchers that just said, you know, we don't know the neural mechanisms of insomnia. We don't know the neurotransmitter systems involved, nor do we know whether any of our treatments really work. We certainly don't understand anything about the genetics of it. And there was, you know, real humility on the part of the researchers who were doing the work. But then you get into a doctor's, you know, or a psychiatrist's office, and everybody can tell you what you're doing wrong. You know, it's like there's no humility at all. There's, on the basis of two minutes, there's a diagnosis of depression or anxiety and a prescription for an antidepressant, which don't really work very well with a lot of people.
What about the, you talk in the book about sleep state misperception.
Yeah.
You know, I had always thought, well, you know, you either you're asleep or you're awake, yeah, or maybe you're kind of drifting between them. But you talk quite a bit about this, the difficulty and the complexity of this issue of sleep perception.
Yeah, well, that's why insomnia. I do understand why researchers don't want to work on it. It is so terribly difficult, insomnia. Here you are dependent upon patient report. It's not, you don't have something you can x-ray, biopsy, you know, do a blood test for, palpate, anything. I mean, it's just, it's invisible. Then you take the patient in and you hook them up to the EEG, electroencephalogram, and this measures the, you know, tells this gold standard for telling you whether you're asleep or awake and what stage of sleep you're in. You know, stage 1, 2, 3, REM sleep. And half the time, an insomniac will show good sleep, normal sleep, about half. It's about, and this was called sleep state misperception. The misperception being, of course, the insomniacs, not the technologies. But the more refined technologies are developed, like neuroimaging, actually does find that insomniacs' brains are quite alert during sleep. I mean, parts of them that are asleep in normal sleep are perking away, lit up like a Christmas tree, as one researcher said. So, in fact, there is something going on there. It's just, you know, the EEG, it's a couple of electrodes on the skull. How much is it really going to tell you? Okay, so for years, this was sleep state misperception. It was the insomniac's misperception. It's a problem of attitude. If the insomniac would get a better attitude, they would know that the EEG was correct and actually their sleep was normal and there was no problem. And this was the reasoning of sleep. I would just come across passages in books that would make my blood boil, you know. So I sent her home to the East Coast with her EEG, telling her she had normal sleep, and I never heard from her again. I thought, the poor woman, you know, she was being talked out of her insomnia. I'm sure she wasn't. But anyway, so in 2004, that term sleep state misperception was changed to paradoxical insomnia, which I thought was just great. You know, finally, you know, you're saying you have two different versions. You have the insomniac's version. I didn't sleep a wink last night. And, I mean, this was also in part of my sleep report, too, that there were 2 hours there that I was sure I was awake the whole time. I knew everything that was going through my mind. And the EEG said I was asleep. So now it's called paradoxical insomnia. You basically have two different versions. They contradict one another. They can't both be true, but they are both true. That's a paradox, which I kind of like. There's a lot of paradoxes with sleep, and that takes me into sort of my original realm, which is literature.
Gail, could you describe, you referred to REM sleep, and could you, or review for those of us who can't quite remember, the different stages of sleep, just to define them.
Well, sleep science actually began with the discovery of REM sleep in 1953. I mean, what that is rapid eye movement. REM sleep is the eyes are just moving back and forth. Nobody knows why. Nobody knows why the eyes are moving back and forth. But the thing is very interesting to me is it had not been noticed until 1953. Now, if you look at a puppy dog sleeping or a baby sleeping, you can actually see this. It's not like you need a neuroimaging, a brain scan, you know. It was not seen because it was not believed. The theory about sleep, the idea about sleep was you turn off the lights, not all systems, obviously, your heart, your lungs keep going, certain things keep going. But basically, the mind kind of quieted down. Nothing of any interest went on during sleep. In 1953, they began to take it seriously, because here, let's see, it was, I guess it's about 60 minutes into the sleep cycle. You know, you start out with the light stages, 1, 2, 3, go into deep sleep for a time, and then you come up into REM. And then you repeat that with different proportions of REM to deep sleep. Some people four to six times, I think, during the night. All of that's completely unthinkable since I wake up out of every REM sleep myself. But anyway, it became clear that a lot was going on during sleep. I mean, that there really was. Sleep was an active behavior, not a passive shutdown of systems during sleep. And so they began to kind of really take it seriously and saying, well, you know, if something is going on there, what is going on? You know, what exactly is sleep doing for us? So, but it's such a sort of lesson in that, you know, we see what we believe. It was not believed that anything went on during sleep, therefore it was not seen. I mean, people had looked at sleeping subjects, but they had actually managed to miss this rapid eye movement. Along with the rapid eye movement, I should say, the breathing accelerates, the heart rate goes up, the brain also sort of lights up as much as during consciousness, and the body is quite activated, except that it's also paralyzed. Mm-hmm. It's called paradoxical sleep. There you have another of sleep's paradoxes, because the body is, the brain is active, but the body is actually, paralyzed is not a good word. Atonia is the word they use, yeah.
And how long would the blocks of REM, REM sleep last for?
In a young person, well, at the beginning of the night, it's just a little, you just get a little REM. You get a long thing of deep sleep. It's very, I wish we had a diagram here, and it's quite regular in good sleepers, the sleep architecture, night to night is quite regular. In insomniacs, it's all over the place. But you get about 20 minutes of deep sleep in the beginning of this stage, a little bit of REM, and then as the stages go on, you get less deep sleep and more REM. So it's kind of inverted, and then toward morning you get a nice long spate of about 20 minutes of a REM, and that's why you often wake up out of dreams, also with heart going, and you know, like you feel like you've just run a race, or sometimes you have.
That's true for people of all ages. I mean, that.
Oh no! That's a young adult. I just described. Yeah, as you get older, deep sleep is 5 minutes or less. Yeah, we lose deep sleep as we get. Everybody gets like me as you get older. But nobody knows why. You know, it's a very complex, intricate architecture. Mm-hmm. And it's so regular in a good young sleeper from night to night that a sleep researcher can say, oh, he's going into REM now. Oh, you know, this is happening. why. You know, why this intricate architecture? Why the two kinds of sleep, the alternation? I mean, there are many, many theories out there, but no certainties.
And is that pattern true in other animals or other primates as well?
I think in primates, as far as I know, but not, no, when you go sort of down the evolutionary chain, it varies. There are some animals that do not have, I'm not sure, maybe all mammals have REM. Don't quote me on that, but I think they probably do, yeah. Mm. I think it Amazing. Sort of happened as we became warm-blooded. Mm.
So, in talking about insomnia, one of the themes of the another theme of this book, there's many really rich in arguments here, is that medicalizing insomnia is really a positive development. And seeing it, we know we hear a lot about the medicalization of society and how all of these just variations in people are becoming medicalized. But here's an example, perhaps like analogous to alcoholism, that getting defined as an illness is a positive development for people who suffer from this condition.
I think it is true because it would call some serious research attention to it, and it hasn't had serious research attention. When I started going to these sleep conferences, I was amazed at how few researchers there were who did insomnia research, and it would be the same guys, you know, this session, you go to another session next year, you go to Europe, it would be the same. I said, where's the rest of them, you know? And then reading the papers, I realized there were no rest of them. It was really a very small cadre. And as I say, I see why. It's very, very difficult to work on. It's not, you know, funded, and there is this tendency to behavioralize, psychologize, neuroticize it. So it seems that, you know, want to define it as a primary condition, as is possibly a, you know, not a normal condition. I mean, something that, well, it causes enormous misery to many, many millions of people. You know that, I'm sure. Call some real research attention to it and also destigmatize it, and we'd get a little less of this sort of, you know, well-intentioned, useless advice.
It seems also that one of the necessities for good sleep research is the validation of qualitative research, and you make a point of how researchers should listen to insomniacs, and that people with insomnia have something to tell, something important to tell researchers and doctors.
I really think so. And I was so amazed that nobody... I would go to these conferences, and I would go around to the poster sessions and sort of introduce myself and say, hi, I'm, you know, an English professor writing a book on insomnia. And they would look at me like I was one of the laboratory animals let loose in the hall or something, like, what? You know, it was like the object spoke or something, you know, and why would we want to know what you have to say or what you know? I mean, one of the things I wanted to know when I wrote this book was, what do insomniacs know, you know, because we live in our bodies and we have inside information about our bodies and we have hunches about, you know, what went wrong and certainly what can help. I mean, what can... you know, things that work. And I was truly amazed that I found one study that used focus groups and that actually talked to insomniacs in my research. And it was in 2006. And I spoke to that researcher. I said, were you surprised at anything that came out of these focus, you know, talking to the patients? And he said, I was astounded at the feeling of, you know, how horrible it was for them and how it had affected their lives and how they had felt nobody had listened. And I said, good, stay with that realization, because that is a really important place to begin. And they have not, they've just not asked us anything. You know, physicians don't have time to listen anymore. I mean, the way the healthcare system is structured, you get 7 minutes with a physician, so you can't expect it really from a doctor. But you can, I mean, it would be good to expect it from a researcher to find out what we know.
Well, I think I would say to make a comparison with Huntington's disease research, there has been a very close relationship with the families who are affected by this disease. And in the Hereditary Disease Foundation, that my sister is the president of, and she's right here in the audience. When we have researchers at a meeting, we always have a family come and talk to the researchers, and then really do an interview, so that the researchers who often work on this condition, this illness, in the laboratory, they may not see, you know, the families or the patients, have a chance to talk to them and find out and hear their voices. So I think that's a really important point that you make. It extends to many areas of biomedical research.
That's really interesting, yeah. I mean, it makes me wonder why it's so lacking in insomnia research, and it must have something to do with this subjective, I mean, that the EEG does not validate us. And also, there's nothing else we can find. There's no biomarker for this disease, you know. And so it's just, you know, do you have it or not? I mean, the diagnosis lies with the patient. But you would think that would be all the more reason to talk to the patient, want to know what they have to say.
Well, perhaps this is the time to talk a little bit about the message, you know, that you for people who share this condition and for fellow insomniacs in terms of what you learned from researching this book and what advice you might want to give.
Yeah, the biggest thing that came through was there's no one-size-fits-all solution, and that, you know, when people go to the doctor and get these 6 or 8 rules to better sleep, they should take that with a grain of salt, try them, of course, and find out which one works, get on the web, read widely, find out everything you possibly can, talk to other people, and then start experimenting, you know, kind of tailor-make something to yourself. There's just no one-size-fits-all, and we get one-size-fits-all, and we're made to feel bad if it doesn't fit, you know. Well, I tried that and it didn't work. Okay, well then try something else. The biggest thing for me was getting control of my hours. I mean, it didn't actually make me sleep that much better, but it made me less unhappy about not sleeping. And to the extent that, you know, people can kind of structure a life that is more sleep friendly and less kind of, I mean, the researchers tell you, you know, get up to the alarm at the same time, regularize your sleep. I mean, that to me is such a recipe for disaster. I mean, all I have to do is know the alarm's going off in the morning and I'm awake there all night long. And I think many people are like that. And if you could just get a more sleep friendly, you know, way of life. But above all, research, inform yourself, find out, you know, what works for you. Trial and error.
Are there support groups
for
people with insomnia?
No. We've been so talked out of this condition that we don't even, you know, well, it's something, I must be something I'm doing wrong, you know, if I could only kind of get a grip. Oh, I just heard this again and again from the insomniacs I talked to. Oh, I know it's me. I know secondary gains. That was another one of my least favorite, you know, secondary gains that you get from insomnia. Oh, yeah, it's really, I get a lot out of having this condition. This one guy said, well, you wrote a terrific book. That's a secondary gain. Thank you. I really would have rather done without the book and been able to sleep. There are just so many ways of kind of passing the buck to the patient, and we've internalized it. I mean, it's my problem, I should get hold, but we have not united in an advocacy group, and that is amazing to me, because there's advocacy groups for everything.
Yes, there is. Yes. I mean, well, maybe you could start one.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's true, because there are support groups for everything, and that kind of communication is incredibly important. And now the internet is another tool that people are using to form support groups, I mean, and form communities, really, online.
Yeah.
To talk about these issues.
I've had a lot of reader mail that has said, you know, well, let's start something. And I said, yes, please do, because it's pretty hard to do an advocacy group.
But actually, you are starting something, because you're bringing this conversation out into the public. Yeah. And I think that's one of the incredibly important things about this book, and especially because you include in it, you've woven together your own experiences.
I really wanted to do that. We've been in the closet with it for so long. There's so many people who are so unhappy, you know, made very unhappy by this. And I don't mean to say that, it can be stress, it can be anxiety, it can be depression, it can be secondary to other things. I'm not saying that all insomnia is a, you know, primary condition of a deficiency of the GABA system, which actually there's probably some evidence for that now. since my book was published, there was a study that came out, but that that it just be talked about it, you know, that people do bring it out and find each other, and also that physicians see it as something serious, not just something. I mean, physicians are actually quite cruel sometimes in withholding medications. And people are really kind of hysterical about sleep medications. You know, where's the next coming from? Where's the next? Because it's tightly regulated. And I think they ought to be available to people, you know, as insulin is to a diabetic or something. I mean, some of us truly cannot live without this stuff. Sorry to say.
Yeah, so that adds to the anxiety. The anxiety of not being able to get medication. Yeah. You had mentioned also the fact that insomnia is invisible. You know, it's like an invisible disability, and that's another part of the difficulty and perhaps part of the shame of a disability like insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you consider that invisibility as a factor here?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, you know, because we pass, and we try to pass. I mean, you don't want to go to work sniffling about, oh, God, I couldn't sleep last night, you know. You really buck up. And also, insomniacs actually perform rather well on certain kinds of tests, attention tests the next day. I don't know. I mean, there's lots of theories for it. One is there's something called hyperarousal. You know, what I think of with hyperarousal, it means you're running on stress hormones, which I think is probably what that means, adrenaline and cortisol, because sleep loss is a stressor. And so when you have a bad night, you've got a real it's like drinking a lot of coffee or something all the time. So we actually perform rather well on next day tests. And this has also discredited us, you know, because we say, well, I'm really in bad shape. No, no, look, you just answered all this stuff. But it turns out, you know, when you look at higher level cognitive faculties, like making decision making, memory, so, you know, long, I mean, really being able to call from working memory into also word, I'm showing it now, grasping for words, we do very poorly. We're actually rather, and the military has been finding this out. You know, they find out about their soldiers that they can fire a round of bullets fine, but they might not always be knowing who they're firing on. And so these incidents of friendly fire, a lot of them have to do, you know, when you run your men into the ground in terms of sleep, you get very bizarre behavior. So in fact, you know, we may do performance tests okay, but if you look at the way we're really performing in our lives, we're not doing great. So you can't see this. You know, you can't test it, you can't measure it. You can, I mean, how do you see something like that? Decision making. You know, I mean, my students were asking me the other day, can we see the nights you haven't slept? And I said, just you tell me at the end of the semester. This would be an interesting study, but I sure can't. I mean, I can tell.
Well, maybe this is the time we should open up the floor to questions. I'm sure that there are a lot of questions for Gail. And there's a microphone coming around.
Yeah. You haven't either defined or described insomnia.
I know.
Could you please?
I should. I'll try. It's not an easy question. That's one of the reasons we... because it's subjective, you know. And so it's defined medically as a complaint because the patient has to come in and complain about it. Otherwise, you know, there's no... You know, the diagnosis is with the patient. But my complaint will not be somebody else's complaint because sleep need is so highly variable. So for me, 5 hours, I'll complain on 5 hours. I know people who do on 5 hours just fine. You know, they do their lives on 5 hours and they seem to function quite well. And they probably do. But it's not a sleep amount, you know. You can't say it's 5 hours or it's 4 hours or it's 6 hours because for me, it's, you know, 5 hours below is my cutoff complaint thing. They used to define it as 30 minutes to sleep onset and then 30 minutes awake during the night. But some people are fine with that. Some people are fine taking 30 minutes to sleep, you know, on set and then being awake 30 minutes. So if you're fine with it, then you don't have insomnia. That is what I mean by fine with it, is that you don't feel your mood or your thought, you know, processes disturbed the next day by lack of sleep. And that's if you have time to sleep. We're not talking about, you know, exigencies of life. So, yeah, it's a subjective. That's why it's very hard to define. Hard to define, hard to diagnose, hard to research. Multifactorial, many different things can cause it. You can see why researchers avoid it. You really can. I understand that now. Does that... you're not happy. I know. I'm not happy with it either. Researchers aren't happy with it. I mean, there are studies that are done. You know, one researcher will do a study assuming a certain thing about an insomnia definition. Another researcher will assume something entirely different. How do you even compare their findings?
Did you ever think about comparing people who complain of insomnia with people who are sleep deprived and simply don't have the opportunity to sleep, like medical interns, residents, people like that?
Well, compare them.
How they function.
That's another variable that seems to be genetic, how people function after sleep deprivation. Probably some interns and residents get away with it, can do it better than others. They're notoriously sleep deprived, as I'm sure you know. And the error, I mean, generally over across the board, the error rates do go up with, you know. But this guy, David Dingies at the University of Pennsylvania, has found that people respond to sleep deprivation. He's Mr. Sleep Deprivation in the country, pretty much. Has a huge lab at Penn, and he's found that people respond just huge variety. He said the mean no longer meant anything. We had to look at the variations, and he found three types. One that was, in his word, catastrophic the next day. I mean, they just couldn't deal with it. You know, they were dangerous on the road, dangerous all over the place. And then the middle, which he says about 60% of the population seems to be in, and they can kind of rally themselves, and they have, you know, they get a circadian second shot of energy, you know, at 6 in the morning. And then there's a third type that doesn't seem to be badly affected at all. They just can kind of sail through it. They don't have these micro sleeps or lapses of attention. They're quite, he just said there's a huge range of that, you know. And, yeah, I mean, those people are lucky.
Both.
Okay. You'll be next. On a biological basis, a group biological basis, my insomnia started because of a break-in when I was in my home, when I was there in the home, mm-hmm. and then a subsequent other event to where all of a sudden, even though psychologically I can do all the work I want to do, it's still in my sleep state. It's a hypervigilance that's going on. So I wonder if biologically, because evolutionary, if we worked as groups, the most vulnerable we would be at during our sleep state as a group. I'm just wondering if has any research been done on group effect or group biology for this actually being part of our makeup. And it's just because we've entered this electronic world, like you said, the adrenaline and cortisol is still there, et cetera, that it's just not exited from our systems.
A couple of points. Yeah, one is the variability does seem to be some evolutionary use for that. Some should be awake while others sleep. That's, somebody's standing guard, somebody's keeping guard. That's one thing. But then the other thing you said, that in our electronic age, you know, we don't return to resting point because... they're finding with kids who are in computer games late at night, this is just disastrous. I mean, these kids are just sitting there and the adrenaline is pumping through them, you know, and those games really do cause a lot of sleep disturbance. But those of us who work late at night, too, are probably doing that to ourselves. And therefore, you should put some kind of a barrier between the day and sleep is a really good advice, I think. that the experts give that I concur with. I don't concur with a lot of what the experts say, but that one I really do make a barrier between sleep and the day and sleep.
Such an interesting topic. I had two questions. One is, if after menopause, if men and women's sleep began to even out in terms of the incidence of insomnia. And then also I remembered, too, they had talked about sleep being very important, a good chunk of sleep for integrating learning. And so that sort of like all-nighters, if you have a choice of doing an all-nighter or not, are not so effective for learning, if that came across in your studies.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They are finding that all-nighters are really, penny-wise, pound-foolish. You know, the memories just do not get consolidated deeply. You might be able to recall them the next day, okay, but they're not going to get integrated into the networks, the other memory networks. And post-menopause, I don't think it actually does go back with women. As far as I know, it's got something to do with temperature dysregulation. Temperature has to kind of go down and stay down for sleep to occur and be maintained. And women seem to have more volatile temperature, like even after the menopausal thing. Although depression rates go down after menopause, but I don't think insomnia rates do, which in itself ought to disconnect the association of menopause and depression. I mean, of depression and insomnia.
If sleep is in fact, as you suggest, an active behavior, I wonder whether anything in the way of analysis have been done of what, 10% of the population that are successful sleepers?
The 10% that are successful?
Well, pick a number. One must assume there are some successful sleepers out there.
I've always wondered why they don't look at those people really closely. I mean, they're just kind of assuming them as the norm, but there are some people who have the gift of sleep, they just have, and there has been some really interesting work on coffee caffeine. The people who can have a double espresso before they go to sleep. Well, it turns out that their bodies retain adenosine. Adenosine is a neurotransmitter that makes you sleepy, and their bodies just kind of, they're not broken down. It's an enzyme that breaks down, and actually they're deficient, but to me they look pretty lucky. So there is probably, some genetic thing for the gift of sleep. I mean, it's a continuum, There's like it's more or less kind of fragile and robust sleep systems. It's like any other system. It's like the cardiovascular system or the, muscular skeletal or the digestive system or respiratory. I mean, we're born with different endowments and they wear out at different times. I mean, some people retain, robustness in a certain area throughout life and for sleep. This goes for sleep too. Not everybody's sleep system wears out with age. But it would be nice if more were understood about this variability of sleep from fragile to robust.
And then there's the other extreme, isn't there? The familial insomnia that's actually fatal.
Yeah, that's a genetic anomaly, though. That they now it's not going to happen to most of us. We don't have to worry about that. Yeah, it's a prion disease, actually. That one. Yeah.
Wow. Yes.
So far, you've commented about the allopathic analysis and treatment for insomnia. Do you have any comments about alternative health treatments for insomnia?
They work on, a lot of people find, help in the alternative realms. We go to those, homeopathy, which, there seems to be no scientific evidence for, but a lot of insomniacs swear by it. I mean, I have their remedies, and and I heard enough of that I really started sort of taking it seriously and respecting it. Meditation, different kinds of meditation, yoga, progressive relaxation things. The herbal stuff is fairly, it doesn't tend to really touch a chronic insomnia, but for people with just mild disorder, sure, there's a lot of herbal supplements, valerian, chamomile. You know, everybody's so various. You just, I mean, so, there's something out there that will work for, can work for most people. I mean, that's the hopeful part about it, is the variability means that, you know, there's lots of things out there to try. There's lots of different kinds of insomnia. So if you keep trying, you might kind of just hit on the right thing.
Yes, right there. Yeah.
I want to eject some optimism. I wonder why you aren't happy about your condition, because I think of all the things you can do. I mean, there's only 24 hours a day, and if I can do with less sleep, and I could, I mean, I don't have time to read all the books I want to read and all the things I'd love to do if I could get along with less sleep.
It doesn't work that way. If only it did. I'm pretty brain dead, you know, and I, especially when I wake up in the middle of the night, my brain is fried. It's just not there to work. So I have I see a lot of movies. I'm really well informed with, you know, I've seen a lot of movies. I mean, I just watch DVDs and I listen to books on tape and, you know, but in terms of work, that doesn't happen to me in the middle of the night. Now, people who are short sleepers, like Dolly Parton, wakes up in the middle of the night, gets inspirations for her songs, and, you know, after 3 hours of sleep. She says, you know, and these people call themselves insomniacs. They're not insomniacs. They're short sleepers, you know. People who actually can function after 3 hours are, they don't have a complaint. They're fine. They're functional. So there's a difference, yeah. Sorry.
Yes, down here in the front.
After taking medication for a really long time, because I've found that's the only way I can get that sleep to work in the normal world, is there any long-term problems doing that every night? I mean, it's...
I know. All right. Here's my advice. Keep the dose low. I'm sure you know this advice anyway. Try not to take it every night. The reason I like Ambien is it's so short acting and it won't get me through a night, but I can usually get to sleep and get some sleep of my own. And one's own sleep is so much better than drugged sleep. So I really find that's really precious to me, you know, a few hours of my own. And then I bite off a piece of Ambien, keeping it as low as I can, you know, And I don't know, it may be a story I'm telling myself, but I'm telling myself that if I get some of my sleep, if I keep the dose low, if I try to go off it in the summer, you know, that maybe I can get away with it. I don't know, I'll keep you posted.
Okay. Yes, in the back there.
Hi, I find it curious that you had a sleep study done and they said that you're apneic. Did they tell you if you were obstructive apneic central apneic?
They didn't actually use that form. They used it was some sleep breathing disorder. It wasn't as strong as apnea. They said there were a few breathing disorder episodes, but I showed this to several people at conferences and so forth, and they said it was not warranted. There weren't that many. I mean, the truth is, I wasn't asleep long enough for them to see that, I don't think. I mean,
okay.
My truth was, anyway. So it was not, you know, that was really not borne out by, well, two experts I showed it to, anyway.
You had a normal EEG?
Right. I actually did try a CPAP machine, and it was the most energizing thing I've ever... It was like, oh, I was awake for the rest of the night after that.
Okay, there are two questions here. And those will be our last question. So here and in the back.
You started out talking about circadian clock. So are there two things here now, the circadian clock and the sleep disturbance? I'm sure you've tried everything, but... If you stayed up till like 3 in the morning, would you then have a better time of sleeping or not?
I do stay up until 3 in the morning, and I think it actually is easier. I think, you know, the disaster comes when I try to force myself earlier. But I'm not one of those delayed sleep phase syndrome people, I don't think. But I bet I have a touch of it. Because I seem to need the late hours. And that is good advice for insomniacs, to really tire yourself out, whatever time that means going to bed. Don't ever go to bed before you're sleepy. That's just you just lie there with your wheels spinning. But, yeah, get good and tired.
I was wondering about the chicken and egg problem with excessive daytime sleep and insomnia. Like if you can't function in the daytime, so you take a nap, and then you're very alert at night and you can't sleep at night, and how it kind of evolves into a whole circadian mess.
Yeah, that's a bad cycle to get into, napping during the day and then staying up at night. Yeah, it's generally recommended to insomniacs that they not nap. And that's actually advice they don't usually even need, because most insomniacs can't nap. I mean, this thing of hyper arousal and with this sort of stress hormones going, it's very hard for me to nap. I can only do it when I'm really, really clobbered. And then I can't do it for very long. But I certainly have seen that happen with more normal sleepers, where they nap during the day and then they're up late at night. Yeah. That sense, regularizing one's sleep is good advice, I think.
Well, on that note, okay. I want to thank everybody for coming here. You have an opportunity to read Gail's book. It'll be for sale out in the front. You have a website too, right?
Oh, thank you. I keep forgetting that. Yeah, I do. Sleepstarved.org. I mean, anybody who wants to share experiences or, you know, things that they've found that work or, you know, anything. That was actually my sort of, I thought, well, this would be an attempt to sort of start an advocacy group, and I haven't really followed through with it. But I really would love to hear from people. So thanks, Alice. Okay, sleepstarved, one word, .org, yeah.
And the book will be outside. I'm sure Gail will be glad to answer any questions, further questions. And if you would like to continue to support the series aloud, I encourage you also to make a donation if you feel inclined, out in the front there. And Louise, do you want to?
No, just thank you both. I hope everyone has a good night.
Yes.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.